everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Dan Nexon, and today I'm talking to Abraham Newman, who is the director of the Matara Center for International Studies at Georgetown University, where he's also a professor in the Department of Government, as well as in the School of Foreign Service. He is an old friend of mine. We actually were good buddies back in high school in some of college policy debate, and he just happens to work a few doors down from me. Hey, Abe.
Hey, Dan.
So thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we are going to be talking about regulatory power, expert capital, and the coronavirus pandemic. Probably wind up talking a little bit more about the first two and then trying to relate it to the coronavirus panic. But can you tell us what exactly regulatory power is and why we should care about it?
Sure. So there's a concept in political economy that's been out for a while, which people call market power. And it's the idea that large markets get to set the rules and standards that other countries follow. And in my own work, what I've been focusing on is the regulatory or institutional dimensions of that idea. So lots of countries have big markets, but often they're not able to set the agenda for other countries. And in my work, what I've called regulatory capacity is the way in which the institutions that focus on particular regulations allow certain countries to then dominate the agenda setting and the implementation of particular rules and standards.
So what is the relationship between regulatory power and expert capital? And what is expert capital anyway?
Well, in order to have regulatory power, you have to have a set of institutions that can define, defend, and enforce a set of rules. And for that to happen, you have to have people and institutions that understand how those rules function. And so in a world of expert capital, you can't just have markets running by themselves, but you have to have a certain set of expertise around how to run those markets and oversee them. And the countries that have that then are in a better position to forward those rules globally.
Can we actually maybe give our listeners a concrete example of this? So I know that we've talked a lot about, we've actually written about how the United States used to have an enormous amount of influence on standards and regulations in the world, and that's declined.
Sure. So a key part of the kind of regulatory power argument is that the United States in the post-war period, even actually going back to the New Deal, developed a whole host of really extraordinary set of institutions. If you think about the Securities and Exchange Commission, or the FDA, or the FAA, all of these bodies were created as independent agencies with extensive human capital resources. So thousands of people working on, you know, how to guarantee aviation safety, how to make sure that drugs were tested appropriately. And in many domains, the United States was really seen as the gold standard of how regulations operate in a modern economy. And this contrasts with many other countries where industries were often embedded within the government themselves and often politicized. So if you think about the French government, it was often very involved in industrial policy, and there was not the same kind of arm's length relationship between industry and regulators. So that's all just kind of on the domestic side. Each country has its own political development trajectory, and the United States in particular found this model of kind of arm's length regulation as central to the way its sectors developed. Well, fast forward to a period of globalization, and you have agencies like the SEC or the FDA. They are setting the agenda not just within the United States, but internationally.
My understanding is that some of this, though, even predates globalization. So the FAA, for example, was not just kind of the gold standard for how you ought to set up regulations of your airline industry, but it was also, you know, FAA investigators were the people who went everywhere, right, to crashes throughout the world and provided expert advice to other countries as they investigated airline accidents. Is that right?
That's right. And often If a medical device was approved by the FDA, for example, then other countries would just accept that as meeting the best practice standards. And so in many domains, a certificate of authenticity by a U.S. regulator proved very powerful, not just for the U.S. market, but for other markets.
And this wasn't, though, just because everybody looked at the United States and said, well, their regulators are really good, their experts are really capable, we should listen to them. It also, I want to bring this back, it has to do with the size of the U.S. domestic consumer market. Is that correct?
Well, I think for this kind of market power to work, you can't have a small economy. It's based on the fact that there's a large internal consumer market that is very attractive, not just for domestic producers, but global producers as well. But I think it's really important to emphasize that if you don't have the expertise to go with it, then it's difficult to make this kind of expert capitalism function.
So you need them both, basically.
Exactly.
So in the 1990s, I remember, I think it was in the 1990s, sort of a moment when the United States was refusing to tackle what a lot of people saw as unfair business practices by Microsoft, right? That is, Microsoft was bundling its internet browser, had driven Netscape to the brink. And the European Union actually then sanctioned Microsoft. And this seemed like a pretty big deal at the time. The notion that the EU was actually now more in the driving policy to some degree for U.S. tech companies. Do I have that story right? And was that actually a development that started to happen in the 1990s, where the European Union starts to play a much larger role, or what has become the European Union in the regulatory and standard setting environment?
So that is that was a really big case. And yes, I think in the 1990s or the 2000s, you really start to see the European Union playing a bigger role. And at least from my perspective, this is because of internal developments within the European Union that go back to the early 1990s. So the European Union, it has this single market project, which really takes off in the late 80s, early 90s. And across a whole bunch of sectors, you see the development of tremendous amounts of regulatory capacity. So you see this in antitrust, you see it in my research, I've focused a lot on data privacy, but there's whole, sectors of the economy that are being upgraded to the pan-European level, and with them, they're creating institutions that go along with them. And I think it's a really interesting reason why we should all look at the European Union is because you can see these regulatory dynamics playing out in real time.
Now, there's a sort of basic argument that I've seen. I think it's Dan Dresner, is that right? That once the European Union becomes a player on the regulatory and standard-setting stage, that the fate of regulation globally and the effectiveness of this kind of regulation depends a lot on harmonization or lack of harmonization between the United States and the European Union.
Yeah, so he had that the book All Politics is Global. And he basically said, if the U.S. and the EU agree, then you get global rules. And if they don't agree, you get some kind of stalemate or fake agreements. The one caveat I would make is that in his book, he's really focused on market power. So like how big are these two economies? And I've pushed him to focus a little bit more on the institutions and how expertise plays a really important role in activating those markets.
So it's more complicated than that. But I raise that example because I think it gets at the heart of this major change, which is that before the 1990s, before the European Union, this wasn't the way things worked, right? I mean, essentially, the United States was the only country with a market large enough to accomplish and regulatory capacity strong enough to set these kinds of global standards. Is that correct?
Pretty much. I mean, the United States was in most places the sole provider of this type of expertise. There were sectors. So, for example, in finance, it was often a duopoly between the Bank of England and the United States. But in general, there wasn't a really great competitor to U.S. dominance in these regulatory domains.
So it sounds more like that in the sort of United States hegemonic sphere, if you want to call it. That is, we're not talking about the Soviet Union and its satellites, that the United States was the only country that had this kind of capacity across broad swaths of the market. So a country like England might have some capacity in one area, or a country like, I don't know, Germany or France might have capacity, or Japan might have capacity in another area, but the United States was the only one who had a kind of full spectrum market power of this type. Is that correct?
Yes, I would say so.
Can you talk a little bit about how China fits into this picture and the rise of China?
Sure. I mean, I think in many domains, the Chinese state is not organized around arm's length, independent, expert-based regulation. Instead, you often see it organized by party and political incentives within the party. And so that really creates difficulties when you're trying to have this kind of expert-based regulatory power. If you take, for example, global financial regulation, you know, the central banks of the world are meeting, and the Chinese central bank is not necessarily viewed in the same way that the Bank of England or the Fed is. Similarly, if you look at the immediate response to the coronavirus in China, it was plagued by internal party political incentives rather than expert-based response.
But of course, and this is a big part of the story I thought that we ought to be talking about, it's also a case that the United States' response has not exactly been entirely driven by expert opinion. Before we kind of talk about the Trump administration and what it's been doing with the, or not doing with these kinds of powers, has there been a kind of general trajectory over the years of the United States losing some of this expert capital? Is this a recent thing, or are we talking about a longer-term story about, in other words, is this a story about Trump not caring about anything but his own political survival and installing lackeys in power, or is this an older story?
Yeah, so let me make a few points. The first is just that even within the United States, you see variation in expert capitalism. So there are some sectors, for political reasons, where the federal government never really developed strong expertise over that sector. An example of this is the insurance sector. So it's you may or may not have elected your state insurance commissioner. And it goes back to the 1800s. There was a Supreme Court case. It was left at the state level. So there are places, an interesting part of these arguments is that you can have variation within countries across sectors just based on trajectories of political development. Okay, that aside, then there's this question of, in areas where you had strong regulatory capacity, why is it degrading in some places? And I think it's definitely multi-causal. The first is, as you mentioned, a push towards deregulation. And so there you have an ongoing partisan fight over whether these agencies should have strong budgets, human resources, whether they should be powerful actors in the regulatory standard setting process. And that has been going on since the 1980s, and in particular, the kind of Reagan revolution in how government should work. Or there's this whole literature on new public management and kind of outsourcing these tasks from regulators to the private sector. At the same time, I think there's a second trend, which is equally problematic for expert capitalism, which is about, you know, it's a partisan attack on expertise. And this has less to do with necessarily the staffing or the budgetary resources, which that argument was more about should markets or government be in control of the market. But this is a set of arguments about how expertise is elitist, and that it really does not produce good outcomes, and it undermines the legitimacy of these expert regulators more generally.
So I listen to those types of things, and I think essentially the story that that comes to mind is that certainly by the 1980s, although this starts earlier, the free market Republicans primarily make a decision that they want to destroy the regulatory state. And they want to do so largely, I think, for a set of ideological reasons. They believe in the market, but also because regulations are getting in the way of profitability of some of the sectors that are important to Republicans. So it sounds to me like what happens is that you get a multi-front war on the regulatory state. You get defunding, you get attacks on the fundamental money and ability and resources available to regulatory agencies. But you also have this political war that you're describing, which is to delegitimate the entire project as, you know, unelected bureaucrats who don't know what they're doing and hate business and are power hungry, and which is then lodged in a broader attack on expertise, which has to do with things ultimately like not only just delegitimizing them, but gets caught up in things like the fight over climate science. Right, so you've got this broader kind of thing going on. And it strikes me that actually most of this is happening for what we may think of as largely domestic reasons. And yet it has this effect on the ability of the United States to wield influence and get what it wants and benefit Americans and even American corporations internationally, doesn't it?
Totally. And I think this is, I have this fight with a whole bunch of people, a bunch of IR scholars who say, well, if large markets want to have influence, then why wouldn't they just have the institutions that would allow them to have that influence? And they should just adopt that, those institutions. And here, like you suggest, you know, the domestic political fights are often driving the weakness or strength of domestic political institutions. But these domestic political fights have tremendous implications for the ability of countries to influence global politics. And so if you think about what has been happening in the United States, it's a very much, you know, domestic politics is neutering the U.S. ability to conduct global affairs. And if you contrast that with Europe, you know, the single market project and all of the reforms that have been happening have been mostly done for internal reasons for the European Union, but they're having very large global spillover effects. And I imagine the same thing is going to be happening in China as well. You see a whole bunch of sectors where the Chinese state, for internal political reasons, is professionalizing and increasing expertise internally within the Chinese state because it's trying to solve internal political economy problems. And those reforms, those administrative reforms, will have very large global implications.
Yeah, I mean, I often think about the story, and I think about it less in terms of political economy, or less in terms of domestic regulation, domestic civil service. And I think about this in the context of, say, the State Department, where, you know, the State Department was sidelined very much under the Bush administration, at least in the first term or the 1.5 terms. And then, of course, between Tillerson's completely wrongheaded attempt to pause and reform the State Department, and now widespread attacks on the State Department as the deep state, you've had a kind of a flight of senior experts in the State Department. You've had it become a less attractive place for the best and brightest to go. And so you've had a kind of destruction of what I would call U.S. diplomatic capital. And it seems like the same kind of story. We're doing all these things for very parochial or narrow-minded reasons, taking for granted the kinds of influence and power capabilities that they gave us. And now, ironically, the state that a lot of the people who are doing these things see as this geopolitical competitor is building these capabilities. And we, instead of having the advantages of having been out in front, are increasingly going to be in a position of having to start from, not from scratch, but from, you know, having sort of deliberately walk back to second base, right, from third base. And to me, that's just sort of, it's really problematic, and it's kind of a little bit insane.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing that's really important to underscore is that these agencies and institutions that you might think of as purely or primarily domestic, so whether it's the CDC or the FAA or the FDA, you know, these things, people will think of, oh, it's about the U.S. market, it's about the U.S. health sector, but they have really tremendous global spillover consequences. And so the State Department, it's easy to see, okay, if we gut the State Department, that's probably going to hurt our diplomatic or international presence. But these agencies, the U.S. agencies, they have, foreign offices abroad in, many countries. They're shaping global policy on some of the core questions of the future of the global economy. And so I think we have to take a broad view on what bureaucratic actors have global consequences. And it's not just those that have international in front of their, imprimatur.
So when I think about how China uses its market power for geopolitical purposes, I primarily think about threats by China to restrict access to its markets from companies that don't take steps to facilitate Chinese domestic authoritarianism. And a similar kind of thing I imagine is happening with other Chinese economic instruments now, like development assistance. And again, I think primarily about it being used to protect Chinese authoritarianism at home and Chinese reputation, soft power abroad. But are there other ways in which China uses regulatory power that we should really care about that has international repercussions? So the other thing, of course, domestically is all these requirements that to enter the Chinese market, you have to have local partners and fears that this has facilitated intellectual property theft and all those sorts of things. But beyond that, which is a huge issue, can we think about ways in which Chinese regulatory power is starting to be felt outside of this sort of very specific political sphere or market power? Right.
Definitely. So I think you're right that the very traditional view of how are the Chinese government flexing its muscle in the economic domain is focused on its political stability and safety. And that is definitely, if you think about the Houston Rockets, they understand the power of this. But I think what we're seeing is that the Chinese government has really learned from how the United States and the European Union have benefited from regulatory power. And they're doing this through a whole series of moves. So at the first level, it's about what I would call extraterritorial application of Chinese law. So there have been a series of antitrust cases where global companies have tried to merge, and then the Chinese government has said, your merger is conditional on you changing something about your operation, even though that the merger doesn't have anything to do with Chinese companies or on Chinese territory. So there was a big mining merger that happened where the Chinese government basically said that the companies had to spin off and sell to a Chinese company part of the different mining affiliates. At the second level, what you see is Chinese experts using expertise in global institutions, international institutions. The most troubling or interesting, depending on your perspective right now, is Chinese efforts in the ITU, in the International Telecommunications Union, to shape the next generation of internet standards. And that would be in a way that would really change from a more decentralized set of standards to a much more centralized set of standards, and that would give authoritarian governments in general more control over the internet, but it would also really shift how large companies would have capabilities within the digital space. And then finally, you see Chinese companies using Chinese expertise to shape global markets. And there, the case of Huawei, which is a provider of next-generation telecommunications infrastructures, is really important because they're coming to dominate many European countries, and they're providing the technological edge in what will be a really critical infrastructure for the world.
This is really interesting because I tend to focus, I've alluded to this before. When I think about these things, I've always tended to focus on the more kind of traditional power politics side, that is, military capabilities, diplomacy. And there, of course, in the diplomatic sphere, as I've mentioned, we see much the same thing, that China is really kind of ramping up its capabilities and is developing better expertise. They're not winning most of their fights yet, say, at the United Nations over human rights issues, but they're certainly winning more than they used to. And there are indications that they're going to get better at this. They're going to be able to bring their resources together more effectively. And then also there's the side of this, which both the Russians and the Chinese have been involved with, which is developing these government-organized NGOs and essentially figuring out how to play the game of waging influence at international organizations. And so they've figured out to do things like put their own government-controlled NGOs in the room, giving all this information, flooding the information space, flooding the persuasion space on kind of human rights and other kinds of issues in a way that has made things much more difficult for the traditional non-government organizations that were truly independent that used to kind of be primarily about liberal advocacy. And so it seems like this is a story across a whole bunch of domains, although the types of capital, diplomatic, regulatory, economic, is different, and also the some of the capabilities that are brought together, some of the sources of power that are brought together with them are different, and then of course the issue domains are different. So to me, this is all kind of interesting because it's sort of at some level this sounds like a very general kind of story that you would expect to happen during power transitions, right? As some states gain more wealth and power, or some actors gain more wealth and power. You know, the kind of realist, the Dan Dresner position would be, you know, they kind of figure these things out necessarily, right? They just, you know, their capabilities start to drive their domestic activities. But of course, in the U.S. case, we see that's not necessarily happening, right? That the United States, as a relative declining power, is not buttressing these capabilities. Are there other examples of ways in which variation nationally, culturally, is affecting still how states and other actors are developing these kinds of sources of human expertise, human capital?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is really a political economy, a domestic political economy story to regulatory expertise, and that it's not a universal, but basically there are winners and losers to developing expert capital. And you see that in the Chinese context, where you often have within a sector a fight between a more traditional party branch of interests and then a group of a more technocratic interests who want to extract the party incentives from the sector in order to maximize economic development. And so if you think about the banking sector in China, you know, there are a lot of party officials that want party-based financing. They want the decisions to be based on political incentives of the party, not about what might lead to economic growth in the long term for a region. Where you have another group of people who say, you know, the party-based financing system is leading to a lot of bad debt that's going to create a huge crisis in the long term. And so they want a more arm's-length technocratic solution. Those fights are happening across all the different sectors within China, and you see similar things happening in the United States, where there's a battle between a group of people that say arm's length regulation produces better results, and then another group that says, well, politically, this is constraining me, and I don't want this constraint. And in both cases, depending on how that domestic political conflict plays out, then it has very large global consequences. And they're often not coupled with each other.
Now, one of the things that many observers argue is that even though the European Union is, depending on when you're looking at it, the first or the second, or now maybe the third largest market in the world, that it has traditionally, in the last few decades, two decades, punched above its weight in regulatory power and in using its market power effectively. Could you talk a little bit about that, like why the EU is so effective, or at least is seen as so effective in using its regulatory power?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is the area in the European Union that is most institutionally developed. So its military capability is its weakest. Even in kind of domestic internal like security issues, it's often less integrated than in its market development. And that is also just a quirk of the integration process, where the single market really ramped up the internal institution building capabilities of the European Union. It's also interesting, if you just think of the arcs of how regulation and regulatory policy developed. In the United States, you had this really large ramping up of regulatory capabilities in the post-war period, and it culminated in the consumer movement. So you think about Ralph Nader and class action lawsuits. And in the United States, what happened is that then the conservative or the business community really pushed back in a effective way, starting in the late 1970s and the 1980s, to do undercut those regulatory initiatives. And in the European Union, you haven't seen that yet. You haven't seen business either because of its influence in politics more generally or its organization at the European level. It has not been able to blunt the regulatory rise that started with the single market initiative and has continued through the last several decades.
Now, let's bring this back to what I promised at the outset, which is what we can learn about what's happening so far with the coronavirus pandemic and political responses from an understanding of market power and particularly regulatory power and expertise. It seems to a lot of observers, I think correctly, that the Trump administration has not been particularly receptive to expertise in a wide variety of areas, and now we saw it for quite some time on coronavirus. It's also been, I think, notable the degree to which the United States has been, frankly, AWOL internationally on this issue in terms of anything high profile. You know, if you think about past epidemics or past pandemics of the last 15 to 20 years, the United States has really been kind of out front, right? The United States played a very important role in the Ebola crisis that happened during Obama's term. Certainly, we had the sense that American civil servants and other American actors were important in some of the discussions about how to handle the SARS outbreak. But here, it just seems like, you know, the United States is not playing the kind of constructive role that we're used to. And I'm wondering how much of that you think is just kind of the politics of the Trump administration and how much of that is something that we are going to see increasingly down the road because of institutional and structural changes that have been happening for a while, but have certainly been accelerated by the Trump administration.
Yeah, so I think a good comparison, or one that I've been thinking a lot about, is the G7 response to the global financial crisis compared to the G7 response to the pandemic today. And there, I think you really see a radical difference, where at the G7 in the 2008-2009 period, there was a whole host of, you know, kind of expert institutional players, the Fed, the SEC, the CFTC. They were all kind of coming together with their peers in other countries and developing a set of responses. And of course, there was political leadership as well. But expert, expert bodies were playing a key role in that process. And today, you really, I think, at the leadership level, there's no commitment to a collaborative effort, but also many of the key domestic players in the United States, whether it's the CDC or HHS, are engaged in, I think, domestic bureaucratic turf wars with each other. And that is accentuated by the fact that many of these agencies have been left to, wither on the vine, both because of budget cuts and de-emphasis on their role in policymaking. If you think about the demotion of the pandemic task force from the NSC, there's been a whole bunch of efforts to extract expert-based decision-making from the highest levels of policymaking.
So when I dropped by your office, and this is actually where I had the idea of making sure that I got you on to do this, we were talking about what was different about the Trump administration response and how the Trump administration has bobbled the coronavirus, the COVID-19 crisis. And you pointed out that these kinds of turf wars always happen, right? They're endemic to the U.S. government. And you said the difference here is not so much that these turf wars are happening, but that nobody is taking control of the reins and forcing the agencies to work things out such that they don't interfere overly with an effective response. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
No, I think that's exactly right, is that, you know, bureaucracies, they always develop mission-sensitive goals, and then they think that those goals should dominate over other bureaucratic entities. And so, you know, the idea that turf wars are going to happen is just a key part of modern government. But what the leadership level needs to do is then adjudicate between those turf wars and also to clear the ground to allow for effective governance. So, you know, what we saw over the fights over the testing kits, where the FDA and the CDC were in a battle over, you know, what testing kit should be used for coronavirus and what would be allowed, you know, that is that's a very standard story in modern governance. But what you would expect is then the leadership level, the White House would say, okay, well, we can't have these fights. This is a national emergency. And so this is what's going to happen. And at least up until now, it's not clear that the leadership level is in a position to do that kind of, leading.
And one of the questions, of course, is whether they're in a position to do that, period, right? If they got their act together, could they do that? Or is it that the White House has centralized decision-making amongst people who really don't know how to do any of this stuff, who have no understanding of the workings of the U.S. government, who prefer parallel task force and other types of, prefer to ask their sister-in-law's father to get information, right, than to actually do the hard work of figuring out what all those flowcharts about government agencies and government and agency turf actually means. So, you know, I don't know. It seems to me that, you know, they certainly are taking it more seriously now. And maybe they've given it over to people who do know what they're doing. But I remain sort of convinced that at some level, there's no way the Trump administration solves this, either in this term or hopefully it doesn't come to pass, but in the next term, unless they start bringing in people who really know what they're doing. And they're not willing to do that because of Trump's obsession with loyalists and people who he thinks are going to help him in his war against the quote-unquote deep state. So I think we're kind of screwed here, I'm going to say. I don't know what your view is.
Well, let me just add that I think, you know, in order for regulatory capacity and regulatory power to really work, it has to be based on transparent and legitimate expertise. And so it can't be based on the fear of retribution or providing illegitimate or providing information that might be seen as making the leader unhappy. And so, you know, we've seen this again and again in the Trump administration where, you know, planes are falling out of the sky, but the administration wants to say the Boeing planes are safe. Or, you know, there's a hurricane coming, but then a Sharpie appears and draws the hurricane path into a different direction. And those kinds of efforts where expertise is seen as not transparent or not really following expert judgment, then it just undermines the whole enterprise. And I worry that we're seeing that right now where the coronavirus briefings are more of a political opportunity than really about talking about hard truths, about what's happening and how we need to address those hard truths. And I think if you contrast Governor Cuomo's, you know, his appearances with the president's, you can see a different version of what, you know, expert-based decision-making looks like. Because I think you do see Governor Cuomo largely just saying, this is what we have to prepare for, this is what's happening, and it's based on kind of hard truths.
What's actually kind of sad about this, but maybe predictable, is some of what you're talking about has to do with what traditionally political scientists have seen as the advantages that democracies have over authoritarian states, right? So the assumption has always been that democracies are more transparent and more accountable. And it's in authoritarian states where you have underlings lying to the leader because they don't want to look bad or they fear retribution. So we think about some of the dynamics that supposedly occurred during the Great Leap Forward, where it wasn't just that Mao didn't care about millions and millions of deaths. That was true, too. But it was also that people were afraid to say they hadn't met their agricultural targets, right? That so the information about how badly the Great Leap Forward was failing wasn't even percolating up. You have the same things about a falsification of growth rates from the regional level in China for a good chunk of Chinese, you know, the sort of Chinese rise. And you also had a sense that this was going on with the coronavirus initially, right? That local officials did not want to admit the scope of the problem because they thought it would make them look bad at the central level. Here, it seems like you've got the same dynamics, but in ostensibly a democracy where people don't want to tell the president what he doesn't want to hear, where when the president decides that something is a certain way, the agencies are meant to backfill justifications for that or explanations of that. And I don't know, it's sort of pathetic and sad, and also has, I think, implications for political scientists' sort of sense of certainty about these institutional differences. Am I overstating the case? I probably am.
Well, I mean, I don't think you're fully overstating. What you see is the president saying explicitly, "I don't want bad news," you know, and then if you give me bad news, I'm going to make your life difficult. And so whether you think about the Michigan governor, you know, who's criticizing the president, and then the president says, well, I'm not going to, you know, help those governors that are being critical of me. Well, that's not going to solve this problem because it's a real problem. You know, like, we need to know the bad news so we can address it. I also think that there is, and this is not just about the president, but it's an underlying issue, which is, in a crisis, should you tell people the hard truth if you can't solve it? And we're seeing that right now with the question about masks. So should people wear masks? And the CDC has been waffling about whether they should tell people to just everyday life wear masks. And the question is, are they saying that because the science isn't clear? Or are they saying that because there aren't enough masks? And so if they tell everybody they should be wearing masks, but they don't have any, you know, then it's going to create a lot of disorder. And I think that kind of, once you start to feel those kinds of erosions of expert capitalism, then it becomes very difficult for individuals in a democracy to make decisions. And so that's why I think we really need to have both the leadership level and the expert level telling the truth to citizens. And like you said, I mean, we've always thought that that was more the case in democracy. But obviously, you know, if you think back to the 1950s and the 1960s, expert communities within the government were not always happy, joy stories. They were also about deception, surveillance, manipulation. And so we shouldn't fool ourselves that life has only been good and now things are going downhill. This is always a tension within societies and also in democratic societies.
It's great that you mentioned that because it actually brings me to the final thing I wanted to talk about. So if we think about the example of 2008, 2009, where all of these technocratic experts got together with ideas about how to solve the crisis, and you had transnational coordination and transnational discussions, it's not that everybody always was on the same page or countries necessarily harmonized their policies, but at least there was some effort to make that happen, right? And to make the best decisions that they could under the circumstances. So you have that kind of example, and then you have the example that you just raised of the fact that the United States does have a long history of technocratic governments being used in ways that I think many on the left rightly see as anti-democratic. So here if you think about that, and you think about the fact that what happened in 2008, 2009, Rob Farley and I were sort of arguing about this on the last Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. You know, for a lot of people on the left, what we did in 2008, 2009 was really bad, right? It was an entrenchment of neoliberalism. It was efforts that did not address structural problems in structural inequality and other kinds of structural problems in contemporary capitalist economies. And it ultimately wound up in austerity measures that generally hurt the less well off. And we wound up with coming out of the crisis with greater inequality and with greater problems, arguably, in the capitalist system, in the advanced industrialized democracies than we had beforehand. So people on the left might look at all this and they say, hey, technocracy is really bad. Technocratic governance is anti-democratic. Look at the ways it was used during the Cold War or even later to mislead Americans or to usurp democratic accountability and democratic decision-making. And then additionally, for people on the left, that a lot of the policies that are pursued have been pursued, certainly in the last 20 years on the economic front by technocrats, have been policies that are associated with deregulation, marketization, the whole bundle of things we call neoliberalism. So what about that? I mean, my perspective has always been that the term progressive is ironically apt for the present moment because a lot of what we've lost in the last few decades has been good government, right? And we need anti-corruption reforms and we need greater transparency, but we also need greater competency. But clearly there is potentially a tension here. So, I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, what should the left think about all these things? How should they balance these kinds of concerns?
Yeah, so I think the really important distinction is to say that expertise or expert-based governance is not detached or devoid of distributional consequences, and that you can have expert-based policies that can offer very different politically important distributional outcomes. Okay, I'm not sure if I'm saying that in the best and the clearest way possible, but just because it's expert-based doesn't mean it's neutral. It's almost never neutral. Those recommendations, the best practices, they have very different implications for the everyday lives and practices of citizens. And the expert-based advice is often shaped by the larger normative structures involved. So, you know, I was recently at a talk by a Green Party official from Germany, and he started his talk saying, you know, I'm for market-based solutions to the environment. And there, you know, you just start from, well, there's all these expertise that has developed market-based solutions for the environment, so much so that even the most powerful green politician in the world probably, you know, has bought into those. And so you always want to view the best practice or standards debates as that they're laden with distributional consequences. But there's a difference between are those expert-based practices, are they attempting to resolve a problem, and then thinking about, well, what are the political distribution consequences of those solutions, and should we accept them? And if you think back to the financial crisis, you know, the alternative that was most present is what we're seeing today, which is complete lack of coordination and a breakdown in a collective response. The second order question is, if we can get a collective response, what should it be based around? And then we can have a fight as progressives or conservatives about, should it be a more market-based or a more distributional, you know, emphasizing equality. But I would just say that the first order reason why we want expertise is that it often produces a collective response, and then we should have a conversation of what should the emphasis of that collective response be.
We should also probably stress that there are different orders of expertise that are at stake here. So there is expertise in the sense of having people who have long careers in an agency of the executive branch where they gain a ton of knowledge about how an industry works, about some of the challenges of that industry, where they draw on a variety of scientific and other expertise in the form of panels and outside advisors, but also people who cycle through the government. That's one sort of expert, which is just, you know, knowing a lot about a subject matter, and therefore, which also includes who do you call and who do you reach out to, right, if you want to get X, Y, or Z done. And then there's expertise, which is a sort of deeper epistemic questions about, so are our economics departments training people in a way that generates expert capital around ideas that maybe don't deserve so much deference?
I actually think that I'm a firm believer that expert-based decision-making, oh, it always comes with a valence. And so it comes out of a particular domestic political economy, a set of educational and elite institutions that develop what is viewed as legitimate and technical and expert at a specific moment in time. And so I think that these, for me, it's rarely that a best practice really is a best practice, but it's found in a particular cultural, socio-cultural moment and viewed as expert. And then it becomes a cudgel that's used to wage political, you know, war, that some groups want it because it helps them get things done, and others try to resist it because it prevents them from getting what they want done. So I do think we should view expert capital not as neutral or above the fray, but part of the political game.
I guess I'll just wrap this up by saying that I think what I was trying to articulate is a combination of two things. One is sort of, as I think Henry Farrell and others would point us to, that one of the ways through the dilemmas of expert capital is to adopt a sort of pragmatist approach, something which is actually very central to some strains of progressive thought, right? Which is to think pragmatically about action and to draw in multiple different frames as much as possible, and not necessarily simply defer to experts, even as you're listening to people who have expertise on certain subjects. You know, and another one is just generally that you deal with these problems by trying to make the ultimate decision about what we're trying to achieve as democratically accountable as possible. And then you just live with the fact that at some level, expertise is socially and historically conditioned, and what we think is the best expert advice may not even be seen as at all right in a century.
Totally. I completely agree.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, and especially given the demands on your time. And I hope that we at least will talk again soon.
Thanks, Dan. It was great talking to you, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Hey, listeners. You've come to the end of another, as we like to think of it, delightfully amateurish episode of the LGM podcast. What's definitely not amateurish, however, is our music, which is provided by LGM contributor Elizabeth Nelson and her band, The Paranoid Style. Find The Paranoid Style's catalog wherever you find good music. Now, this is the point where I'm supposed to tell you that if you like the podcast and you like what we do at the blog, you should donate to our Patreon or directly via the link at lawyersgunsandmoney.com.